Hi everyone, welcome to ADHD Brief. I'm Kaylee Smith, a registered psychotherapist in Ontario and your host. This isn't your typical therapy podcast. Here, I ditch the clipboard and sit down with friends, family, and people with lived experience to have informal, unfiltered conversations about ADHD, mental health, and what it's actually like to live with a neurodivergent brain. As a therapist, I love having these conversations, but this podcast isn't therapy and it isn't intended to provide personal clinical advice. It's real talk, personal stories, and don't worry, we still try to keep it funny. Whether you've been diagnosed, you're exploring your brain, or you're just ADHD curious, welcome. Brains don't always play by the rules. Let's talk about it. Welcome to the most impromptu ADHD podcast of all time. And so today we're just going to start freeballing some questions. I want to talk to both of you about ADHD, and I want to hear a little bit about both of your journeys with getting diagnosed, getting treated, because I feel like the three of us are in sort of different stages of understanding our own ADHD and our journey of treatment. So who do we want to start with, Matt or Julian? We're starting with Julian.
You're starting with me.
Tell me about getting diagnosed with ADHD, where you're at in the process.
My first diagnosis or second?
Whichever diagnosis.
I was diagnosed when I was, first diagnosed when I was a child, because I was the quote unquote poster boy of overactive and hyperactive and didn't listen and, struggling with school and focusing and sitting still. So I was, to cut it short, medicated.
Okay. How old were you?
I was about eight years old. I was medicated from the ages about 8 to 12. You're in grade 7 when you're 12. I remember being in grade 7 when I came off the meds.
Okay. Do you remember what med you were taking?
Ritalin.
Okay.
Good old Ritalin.
Okay.
Yeah.
That tracks for the 90s, early
2000s. Yeah. The numbing pill.
I'm assuming it was probably the short-acting Ritalin.
I was on 2 doses a day, or a dose and a half. So I would, morning before leaving for school, so that, it was, took effect by the time I got to school. And then, at lunchtime, I would, head down to the office, to the health room, we called it. And, they would administer my half dose, which by the end of the day, quite honestly, I was just a piece of shit. Can we say that? that ended when I was 12, when I sort of came into the awareness that this did not feel good, and I was able to articulate that to my parents and let them know that I didn't like this, it wasn't good for me. It was starting to actually cause more of a deficit. Played hockey all my life, and until I was about 17, and I started, my coaches started questioning why my energy was low, and because it was the effect of the Ritalin, but it was, their intention was for it to help me focus on the ice and improve my game, which it definitely did not do.
I can imagine too, you're probably having hockey practices after school evenings. So meds are already wearing off at that point anyway. So
I'm just crashing and not even wanting to go. I actually remember losing an interest in hockey. I didn't want to do much of anything. I just wanted to sleep. And
do you remember what it felt like during the day when you would take it?
I don't know if it was the meds or the trauma of the whole thing, but I don't have a lot of vivid memory of when I was medicated. It kind of was like a pause button in a way.
Do you remember what it felt like when you'd be pulled into the office midday to take medication? So I can imagine that even that alone might feel uncomfortable for a kid to have to do, to be kind of singled out like that.
Well, it actually started where they, because this was a new thing with Ritalin, and back in the 90s, there wasn't a lot of policy and regulation, I guess, around how the school board and teachers and the school themselves handled a situation like this. Kids weren't ever really medicated. For ADHD at least. And I started in the beginning, it was left up to me to, I had the pills in my backpack, like in the hallway. So at like lunchtime, I'd be out in the hall. And I remember actually one day And I remember the person it was, I won't name names, but I was in the hallway and I reached into my backpack after we had had lunch and we were going for recess because I had to take it after I ate. And I reached into my backpack and pulled out the bottle and bit my pill in half because I had to take a half. And the kid beside me saw the bottle and was this whole thing started in grade four. Four? I think it was grade four. Three or four. And he shouted out, "Julian's doing drugs. Julian's a druggie." And this whole teasing started of like, "Julian's a druggie." And I was obviously embarrassed of the fact that I was taking this because I had behavioral issues. And I mean, or at least that's what was presented to me. And that's what was explained to me. So yeah, this thing started where like rumors started spreading around and it caused a disruption. So that was the reason that I had to then start going down to the office every day
to take it,
which was supposed to, which was supposed to be like more discreet, but yet at this point everyone knew why I was going every day. So that didn't really solve that.
Did anyone ever explain to you what ADHD was when you were a kid? Like they just said you have to take this pill because
I was hyperactive.
Okay,
that was it. That was really all that they The whole experience of getting diagnosed was really strange. It felt more like I was being studied.
Yeah.
I remember going into like the soundproof booths and wearing headphones like you guys are. Did you have to do the same thing?
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it's like,
okay, we're on to you next. Don't worry.
And the soundproof booth, I remember being in there and looking through the window at my pediatrician who diagnosed and medicated me and repeating the words that he was saying to me. And I was wearing those big headphones. I remember them and they look like the sound, like the ones hunters wear with they're like beige. You know which ones I'm talking about? And they're like these big ass headphones. And I remember them sitting on my head and repeating words. And I just remember him saying, "Stupid." And I had to repeat it back to him. And I don't know why that's the only word I remember him making me say. And I felt like it was a test at the time, too. Like, why are you making me say stupid in this test? Like, I'm being tested. And like, so I started kind of developing a complex.
You start internalizing that as, is this why I'm doing this? I'm stupid?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the whole thing was really uncomfortable. I didn't like it. Obviously,
it deterred you from wanting to take medication
for a number of years. I kind of believed that it was going to help me and it was going to fix whatever was wrong with me because I was a kid and didn't understand it and it was going to help me focus and succeed is how they, not in those words, but today is how I would translate it is that's what was kind of presented to me and that's what I believed because, I was a child, so I didn't know any better. But going back to your question, the experience of going to the office was actually, okay because my, who I call my aunt, my Zia, is actually my mother's maid of honor from when they got married. She worked in the office at the time at my school and she was the one that I went down to see. And she would give me my pill. So it wasn't as uncomfortable because she was one of those adults as a child that I didn't feel uncomfortable around or didn't feel inferior around. She didn't treat me that way. So I felt okay and comfortable. And we kind of had this thing, I remember at like family gatherings, it was like, why do you always go to the office? People would ask and like probe and she would always kind of just, that's our business. That's Julian and my time. So it was oddly comfortable to go down and get the pill. There wasn't really much no negativity surrounding that, but.
And so this is a perfect snapshot into why a 50-minute session with someone that's got ADHD goes by so quickly.
We've been here for 50 minutes.
The non-linear thinking of trying to break down one question into all of these different parts.
Did you say that was 50 or 15?
50-minute session.
Has it been 50? Are you talking about your session?
I'm talking about as a therapist.
I see. I understand. Okay.
Trying to conduct a 50-minute session with a client that's got ADHD because that's how quickly your brain can process information and how you think in a very non-linear way. So one question turns into this, to this, to this, to all of these different segues, and it's hard to focus.
Right.
Yeah.
And like that being said, I remember, bless you. I remember expressing that as a child and being told, well, everyone has a lot of thoughts in their head. You just need to control it and think about and just focus. So for a lot of my life, it was just, I'm sure with you too, and with you, it was just people telling you, just focus, just do it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's an incredibly stigmatized disorder in the sense that even just like the criteria of ADHD, anybody can display at some point. Like everybody makes mistakes. Everybody's forgetful. Everybody, you know, gets impatient sometimes. Everybody happens like this or this happens to them, but people don't realize that when you've got ADHD, this is a chronic pattern and it's stuff that impacts you in, you know, multiple facets of your life all the time. It's not just, I forgot my book bag once. It's like, I forgot my book bag. I forgot to brush my teeth. I forgot my homework. I forgot it was my mom's birthday. I forgot, continue any other example.
Sure. Yeah. It felt as though it was confusing. I'm only realizing kind of now that from when I was diagnosed and tested and treated and all that stuff. And it was like, there was, you know, an acknowledgement of this disorder that I had. And after that, it sort of just got downplayed and swept under the rug as if, well, that wasn't really real.
Mm-hmm.
So I started turning my nose up to it and believed that I wasn't ADHD or I wasn't ADD, or it became a joke where it was like, oh, it's my ADD.
Yeah.
And it almost became, I started becoming very aware of that. And I felt as though it was a cop out for me to blame it.
I hear that all the time, that people think that you're using it as an excuse.
Yeah.
People think, well, I don't want to use this as an excuse, or I don't want to say that, you know, ADHD is impacting me in this way, because that's just an excuse, when in reality, it's an explanation.
Right.
It's coming to a place of acceptance on, oh, this is actually how ADHD has been impacting me my entire life in all of these different ways. Because I think even just the idea that ADHD is supposed to go away as you get older is very telling of what literature, what research used to say, which is you grow out of ADHD. Now we know that that's not the case. And this thing that impacted you so severely as a child is still going to impact you. It's just going to look different when you're an adult.
Yeah. It's just so ridiculous to think that they could make a claim such as it, you'll grow out of it, when they hadn't even studied someone from childhood to adulthood at that point.
I mean, they had, like, ADHD has been something that's been documented since the late 1800s. So it's just how it's how it's stigmatized in society in terms of what, you know, people's beliefs are and what people want to research. And like, now we're in this whole movement on ADHD advocacy and really understanding all of the different aspects of someone's life that it impacts. Because you, as you were just saying, in terms of getting diagnosed as a kid, going off Ritalin in your preteen years,
going right into puberty and coming off Ritalin.
After that, you didn't start getting diagnosed and then retreated until approximately 1 to 2 weeks ago. So Julian's a newbie in the ADHD treatment journey.
Yeah, officially diagnosed and treated in the last couple weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, a big...
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Welcome to the club.
It's life-changing, definitely. An emotional journey.
Yeah.
It started longer than that. Longer time before that, in terms of the journey of accepting and sort of reassessing myself and resetting and being a little more open to the idea. That was really tough, because I carried that, you know, that downplayed kind of attitude that was presented to me afterwards with me for 20 years.
Yeah. And I do. I want to get into that emotional journey a little bit more. I want to hear from Matt. Mm-hmm. What are your kind of reflections on your own journey of diagnosis and treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the room with the headphones and the whispering.
I never went to this room.
Really? No. I thought I was there for a hearing test, so this is confusing because it wasn't until right now that I realized it was not a hearing test.
Ooh.
So that's
weird. I couldn't understand what hearing had to do with why we were here.
Yeah.
Like, I could hear perfectly fine. What was wrong with my hearing? Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, both of you, don't remember anyone ever explaining to you why you're going into this room. Wow.
No.
I mean, I don't really remember what I had for breakfast. Well, we had waffles, but usually I don't know what I had for breakfast. So you know, rewind to when I was 7 or 8. There's no chance I remember going into a creepy room with headphones. I just remember him whispering airplane, and then I'd have to say the word back.
Yeah.
And I was in like a decompression chamber. Yeah. And I had to sit in front of that computer and like push the space bar every time I saw something. It was a pattern or a repeated word or something. I'd have to... And then I'd be like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Well, I think the most
diagnosis.
Well, no, I was going to say too, I think it's very interesting because that's one of the things that we now kind of know when you're doing psychoeducational assessments on kids is that that's not really a true representation of a child's attention because they're in this controlled environment where A, there's no distractions, B, they're potentially scared. They're almost like hyper fixating or hyper focusing on whatever it is they're being told to do. Mm-hmm. So a kid might test showing that no, they have no attentional deficits. And then they go to school on Monday and it's the complete opposite because they become hyper focused on trying to master whatever it is they're being told to do in that moment in terms of testing.
And there really was nothing else to focus on at that moment, aside from your own fear and the person who's talking to you through these like three panes of glass. The strangest room, like I didn't get the point of it. And you mentioned the button, and I'm only remembering they played tones, and when there was a tone, I had to hit a button.
Oh,
just
maybe
beeps.
It was
just beeps in my ear. I'm only remembering it when you said the button thing.
Yeah.
But back to you, sorry.
Okay, talk about your early journey.
Well, I was in a similar situation. I was put on Ritalin, and my mom being a nurse and my dad being a male boomer hated drugs. My mom loved the drug. And so I would get Ritalin when I was at my mom's, and then my dad wouldn't let me take it when I was there. Yeah. So it was like this, I never actually got that consistency of having the effects of Ritalin. So I didn't, it just gave me an upset stomach. So I was like, taking this sucks because I don't feel good. But then, you know, fast forward to now and I have the appropriate Vyvanse. It's like, oh, this is actually, I could have had 20 something years of solution.
Yeah.
But I didn't. Because...
Well, because I think medication has come a long way from the time you two were kids in terms of different medication options and longer acting medications, where now if someone's having adverse reactions to one medication or one class of medication, they can at least try a different class. It's not just if you're a boy and you've got ADHD, you get Ritalin and that's it. That's your only option, because Ritalin is part of the methylphenidate class. Vyvanse, which now both of you are on, are the amphetamine class. So completely, completely different class type, and your brain can respond very differently to it. And
I think she's just using big words to try and confuse us.
She's working.
Absolutely crushing it. Yeah. Oh, the dog wants up. Come on, buddy. You need to come do your podcast?
Oh, yeah.
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 Harvey's also ADHD.
Yeah. Yeah, we've also got an ADHD puppers over here. So we'll have his attention for a few minutes and then it might go to something else. So tell me about when you got re-diagnosed as an adult. Like, what had been happening for you from the time you were a kid, you stopped taking Ritalin, to you got diagnosed in your very early 30s.
Yeah. How old am I now?
When he started dating me.
Yes.
Yeah. Might I add.
That's what happened. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was lucky enough to somehow figure out life with ADHD to, I guess, the best of my ability. So I was able to get into a career and like hone skills in sales, and then, you know, somehow, I'm still not 100% sure how, managed to kind of transition into a career that was outside of my scope of schooling. Mm-hmm. And
you went through multiple different careers through life.
If I had a dollar for every business that I opened, mm-hmm. I would be we wouldn't be doing this in our basement. So yeah, I mean, I was able to stick with a career and you know, do okay financially, but yeah, there were so many distractions.
Do you know why that career was something you were able to stay with?
Yeah, well, sales. I think sales is a great place for somebody with ADHD, because yep. you're always chasing that dopamine of that win, you know. And with my career, it's multiple wins per month, so it's not like a long 2 or 3 year sales cycle. Mm-hmm. It's like every 20 or 30 days.
Yeah, so it's an intermittent reward schedule. I think it's also challenging.
Very challenging, yeah. And then
it's different day to day.
Yeah. And then it also had a good financial reward as well. So I could win at work, and then I could also reap the benefits financially of those wins. Mm-hmm. So, and then those financial wins turned into
different hobbies,
cars, boats, you name it.
Airplanes.
Yeah. Yeah. We could go down the spiral if you really,
oh, we're going to get into, tell me about your list of hobbies. Oh, we're going to start a scroll on the wall.
We don't have time for that.
Not the wall.
Yeah.
This podcast studio being the newest hobby.
This week.
You're welcome. It was not here a few days ago, and look at what we have set up now.
Oh, yeah.
Stay tuned for our next episode, and I'll tell you what the latest hobby is once the dopamine is worn off here.
Yeah, we could probably start that episode tomorrow. I'm sure I'll find something between now and then.
What have you noticed has been a change for you since you've been back on medication, or like consistently on medication as an adult?
I'll have to edit that long sigh out.
Use it for effect.
Yeah. Dramatic effect.
Yeah. Edit that out though.
I think it's a tough question, 'cause there's so many different things. It's helped with not being as tired throughout the day. I don't have those peaks and valleys throughout the day as much as I used to. Difficult tasks, though I still don't want to do them, I am able to do them. It has helped in many different ways. It hasn't been a cure-all, mm-hmm. but it has definitely brought my baseline up to a more normal standard, mm-hmm. and that's been very helpful. Mm-hmm. And I was never really the anxious type, so I didn't live in an anxious state, but when times do get hard, I find that I don't get that level of anxiety as much as I would have back when I was mm. off meds, though there is still a level of anxiety that does, I think that's just normal.
Yeah.
But it's definitely helped with that. And then depression it's helped kind of curb it. The influx of depression. It's not so deep.
The lows aren't as low.
Yeah. I don't fall off a cliff, you know. It's just like, oh, I have a bad day now, instead of, oh, I had a bad 3 days and I couldn't get off the couch. Yeah. That's it.
Okay. What about you, Julian?
What was the question again?
Getting treated, like starting medication as an adult, what do you notice is the difference of what you're like off medication versus on medication?
I like myself more. Mm-hmm. I have more confidence in my ability. It's fairly new for me, so I'm still navigating it. And realizing, kind of every day in moments, like, holy shit. And I just did this and it didn't hurt. Yeah. That wrenching, like right in your sternum, like that wrenching pain isn't really there anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's replaced more with like a flutter now.
Okay.
Like an excitement. At first I thought it was like something was wrong with my heart. but I realized that, you just said too, like when you're faced with a challenge, you're not just immediately drowning in this anxiety of all the things that you need to do.
Overwhelm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's like a bunch of just, I don't know why I'm using pebbles, just being thrown at you. And like, it's just everything everywhere. It's, now it's a thrill. Like I get to solve a problem and it's exciting because I know that I'm going to do it. Whereas before I just couldn't bring myself to focus on one thing. And until of course the 11th hour when I would bang the shit out of it and then just crash. Mm-hmm. And those would be the best sleeps I would have. It's like getting that one. Cause it's like that win, chasing that dopamine. Mm-hmm.
Well, it almost allows your nervous system, instead of just having an on-off switch, it like almost gives it a bit of a dimmer switch. Like it still is like on or off, depending on if it's something you're interested in, if it's something that you're motivated to do, if it's something that's like got enough of a reward or there's enough of a consequence that it motivates you to do it, but at least it's not like completely all or nothing. It's like you can kind of gear up to getting there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that there's a buzz. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's gone from anxiety to more of like a throttle, like an acceleration, more fuel that I now have to pump into the engine to finish the race and get the thing done. And it's it's great. It's clarity. Mm-hmm. I'm able to finish a thought. The biggest thing I've noticed is the lack of me craving or needing to smoke marijuana.
It's a big one.
Yeah. Yeah. I never really ever thought that like I would go on vacation and my thought was going to be like, I'm not gonna be able to smoke weed for a week.
Yeah.
Going to Europe for 3 weeks. And I'm like, and it wouldn't be good because I'm like in paradise and beautiful town in Italy and mountains. And I just want to be the fuck alone because my mind is not allowing me.
Because you don't have medication in the sense of what you're using to self-medicate.
Exactly. Yeah. Which prior to that was alcohol.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've known me for a while and you knew how much alcohol I would consume on a daily basis. And when I finally cut the alcohol out, I think that was the first step to me looking for a proper solution.
Yeah.
Because though I was able to in some way function with the alcohol, I couldn't function by just being high all the time. Mm-hmm. Though it helped the anxiety and I felt great, I wasn't actually functioning. It didn't help me focus on the things I needed to do. It was now it was making me focus on the things I wanted to do that just excited me and gave me more dopamine. So the important tasks were important.
Yeah.
It was the fun ones that were important to me because they made me feel good. Until, of course, that wore off, and then the existential dread just came barreling back in because I haven't done any of the things I need to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, once I stopped drinking, it got hard. It got really hard. And it was a journey over the last couple of years getting to the point I am now where the biggest challenge was getting the diagnosis.
Yeah.
And I went through trying to locate that childhood diagnosis because it's tough to get one as an adult.
Yeah.
And it costs money, which is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But
especially considering that by the time people with ADHD are getting a diagnosis, it's because their life is potentially in a state of crisis. They've lost their job, or they're, you know, they've lost their relationship, or they're, mm-hmm. you know, in so much debt, or they, you know, are losing their home, like something is happening, mm-hmm. or they're in a mental health crisis, they're suicidal, they're, you know, engaging in alcohol or drug abuse because mm-hmm. they can't function. And so all of the things that are required to get an ADHD diagnosis can feel impossible because it requires a lot of executive functioning to be able to go, okay, do I have my records? Do I know how to contact my doctor? Can I make an appointment? Can I show up for the appointment? Can I remember when the appointment is? Can I make sure that I'm remembering all of the things I want to say? And then how do I, you know, take all of that to someone else? Like, there's so much that's involved in it, and there's, it's a huge barrier for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then you get to the point of, when I actually do get diagnosed, now I've got to pay for medication that is very expensive and sometimes not feasible for people.
Yeah, exactly.
There's still a lot of unfairness in that system. And yeah. I know too, because you two are in kind of different stages of getting diagnosed. Matt's a few years in. What are some of the emotions that you've gone through? I know he loves talking about feelings.
It's my favorite topic.
I'm married to a man that has a hard time talking about feelings.
Yes.
And I love them.
You can imagine our fights. Very quiet.
That'll be on the second episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be a live stream.
Yeah, we can live stream it. It'll be awkward being like, hey, we should go down to the basement and continue this fight. That feels like pouring gas.
But I think we should also do two versions. One, if we're having an argument when both of us have meds on board, like in the morning, midday, versus right before bed, because they're two completely different arguments.
Yeah, you don't want to fight me in the morning, though, because...
You're going to lose.
Yeah.
Because that's when I win.
I actually have yet to find a topic or time as to where you have not won. So
anyways, we digress. Tell me about your feelings.
Yeah, feelings. I was trying to get out of it. God damn it. I mean, yeah, when I first started taking the Vyvanse, I would pull into work and I don't know what I'd be thinking about, something, you know, my dad, anything. And a song came on and I would just start crying. I don't know. It would just be like this overwhelming emotion. And for like the first 3 days, I would say first 3 or 4 days, and it would just be just this visceral, gut-wrenching emotion. And it would be so overwhelming. But that obviously went away. But I think it helps with some emotional clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But thank God the crying's over. I just...
Well, as I think, you know, I at least always say to my clients that there's quite a few different emotions that you're going to experience through this process, and they're all normal. So there's, you know, relief in the beginning on, oh my God, I finally have an answer. I finally have something that's going to work. I can finally feel like life is more manageable. I mean, there can be anger around, you know, how did this get missed when I was a kid? Or how did I not get the help that I needed? There can be a lot of grief around all of the lost years or lost potential or suffering that you've had to endure without having any sort of treatment or support. And I mean, there can be, yeah, like sadness, loss, excitement about the future. Like there's all kinds of stuff that can come up.
Yeah, it was frustrating when you become medicated to then see all of the changes and the positives and be like, I didn't have this for the last X amount of years. And that
your whole life.
Yeah. It's like that feeling of loss. Like I lost out on 20, 25, I guess in my case, almost 30 years of being normal or being able to run at a normal baseline,
yeah,
and not have to work so hard to get up to a baseline and then still become an overachiever. It's like the expenditure of energy was so great to just get to that normal baseline. And I say normal is just as a term, but then to go above and beyond that and actually be a high achiever, there was nothing left in the tank. Mm-hmm. So I found that was very frustrating to have that clarity and realization at 32 years old.
And when you say overachiever, do you mean that in relation to like perfectionism?
Yeah. And just being like really trying to be really good at something, like, at the sales.
The other people.
Well, I always want to be better. Like in my sales role, I would be the top salesperson all the time. And everything I did, I wanted it to either the perfectionist side of things, or I would just want to be the best in that space. So just to get up to everybody else's level was hard, but then to get above that and really absolutely fucking crush it was so hard to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense because it takes more of your capacity just to keep up with certain things.
Yeah.
And then I think too, it's interesting that you talk about overachieving or perfectionism, because I think that is very much related to ADHD shame. You carry this shame on what's wrong with me. Why can't I keep up? Why do I forget things? Why do I let people down? Why am I stupid? Why am I lazy? Like all of that, those negative things that you've either been told or you now think about yourself. And then as an antidote to that, you double down on perfectionism. I'm going to be the best. I'm never going to make mistakes. I'm going to, be the best salesperson, be the this, that, and whatever. And then if I can't achieve that, then I feel this shame again. And I don't want to feel that because I've been carrying that weight around for years or decades. Mm-hmm. I'm going to double down in perfectionism, and that cycle just continues.
Yeah. No, yeah, you nailed it. And the exhaustion that comes with trying to do that overachieving and the perfectionism and the financial strain that brings is then turns into another shame spiral in and of itself. Cause you're like, well, I just spent all of this time on this thing. I put all of this energy into it. I put all of this money into it, and look, something else is shiny. And then you're moving on to that. And you're like, well, I just wasted all of this, but now this new thing's so exciting and shiny. I'm going to focus all my energy and time into this. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to feel the shame about that, but the excitement's going to cloud that for now. But then when this gets boring, now I have two things that I'm going to be able
to. Now we're unpacking his hobbies.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I'm unpacking Matt's hobby cycle.
I'm just going to be ashamed about all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I don't want you to feel ashamed of any of it. I think all of it makes sense.
It does. It's just, it's like, it's hard because I think a lot of people in this situation, you know better. Like, I do finance for a living. Like, all I do is help people with their finances, and I know what to do and I know what not to do. But then I get into that hyper focus dopamine searching mode where I'm like, I'm going to do this. And it's like, well, you shouldn't spend money on that. It's like, no, yeah, shut up. Don't shut up. I'm doing it because if I do it, I'm going to be able to turn it into and then interject whatever you want to make it seem like a rational decision. Yeah. Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get good at it. I'm going to turn it into a business. Then I'm going to make that money. And then the money that I spent, I'm going to make it back. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And then that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And I'd say too, for you, the way that you've described it is it feels very obsessive in nature. Like you can't not think about it or not buy the thing, not build the thing, not research the thing. Like that craving of dopamine is so intense for you that it's like that consumes you. At least that's how you've described it to me.
Well, it is. So not to brag or anything, but like this whole entire podcast setup is auto editing itself as it goes, switching cameras based on the mics, and the lighting is all professional, and all the gear is
We couldn't just get like a small microphone to make a podcast.
We had to
build an entire stage.
Paint the walls.
So, yeah.
He left work early to build this studio. Twice.
Yeah, and I didn't.
I thought he was finishing our home renovations that have been half done for 2-ish years. But anyways, we're not poking fun at you. We're not shaming you.
No.
It's all good fun.
Yeah, no, and I get it. And it's like I will just hyper focus on I want to learn this. And,
yeah.
It's people call it a superpower, but I think that's silly. I don't know. It's, I know everybody has their own feelings about it, but it is in a way very helpful because you can learn to get into something and understand it very quickly.
Yeah.
But it also strips your ability to have relationships with people because it's hard. Like I'll, you know, come home and I'll hyper-focus on this. I'll come home at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock, start working on this, and I will completely forget to come and say hi to you or have dinner. And it'll be 11, 12 o'clock. And I'm like, oh my God, I need to stop learning how to do this stuff and then go and pay attention to other people. Or,
yeah,
you know, I'll see you every day, but I'll not see friends for a week because I'm like, I need to learn how to do this thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just gone.
Yeah.
And then there's no energy left to expend to spend time with you or friends. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's helpful that you're at least married to someone that also has ADHD and understands it in comparison to past relationships?
Yeah, it's definitely helpful. I mean, I think it's a two-way thing. It's like, it's helpful that now I understand it because then I can give myself a little bit of relief and empathy. But it's also helpful that I don't get shamed on a regular basis when I am gone. Either I'm sitting beside you and thinking of the next best thing I'm going to do, or I'm just not physically around because I'm building a fucking car in the garage or creating a podcast studio.
Literally, there is a car being built in the garage.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's two. What about you, Julian? Do you feel like it's impacted your relationships with people or your relationship with yourself?
Oh yeah.
Like, I don't know if you feel like you're on the same level of hobbies or interests the way that Matt is, because I mean, ADHD is going to present differently in everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I have anyone who knows me knows my hyperfixation and that's plants. Mm-hmm. And in the last, I think, year and a half, I've propagated and grown like over 350 plants that I have in multiple locations across the GTA.
There's a few of them upstairs.
Yep. This house being one of them. but it's definitely impacted relationships as well as my how I feel about myself. Yeah, I've been pretty hard on myself about it, and only recently have I how do I phrase this? I've never really felt hope before. Like, believed that something will work out the way or just work out. Whereas now I feel like every day I'm getting closer to not one particular goal, but just not succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't feel a constant fear of what am I gonna do?
Yeah.
I'm more in the mindset of I'm gonna do something, and that's enough for me because I know that I'll be able to do it and execute it. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, being on the medication isn't the only, it's not, you know, the medication isn't the only time that I feel good now. I feel good. I mean, right now, it's worn off. That's gone. I'm like, I'm in crash mode. But I feel good because I know that it's there and it's going to help me, and that I can take a pause and take a break at night and not worry about tomorrow morning when I would normally. I don't procrastinate anymore. You kind of stop procrastinating.
Mm-hmm.
You're just taking a break.
Yeah.
Whereas before it was always taking a break from everything.
Mm-hmm.
Even with plants, like I would neglect them and some of them would die because I would procrastinate them. I'm able to take that time now. And then, the next day, once I'm up and running, I'm good to go. And I know that I'll handle it then. So that anxiety goes away.
Yeah.
Before you were asking about before the Vyvanse, I
went off topic.
That's okay. I forgot what I asked you, so.
How it's affected relationships.
Yeah.
I think I don't want to blame it, but I think that I think I could have handled a lot of relationships better than I could have, had I been able to.
Because I see both of you and how it's impacted relationships in different ways from my point of view.
Yeah. I mean, our relationship was, I kind of just blocked off from everybody because
you isolated. You retreated.
Retreated. Yes. I was not treated. I retreated.
He was also not treated.
I was not treated. I was not treated and retreated. To dive into it, I up until recently, I just loathed myself and had no idea how the next however many years that I'm walking this earth was going to go. And the last year and a half, I quit my job last year. On a whim. It just got too much, and I blame the job, and I'm regretful only because if I had been treated, I would have been able to work through that.
Yeah.
Not completely regretful, but it just sucks that I feel robbed of that opportunity.
Yeah.
I feel like I had a really great opportunity.
Of the things that went wrong that you would be able to overcome. Or at least push through at this point that you weren't able to.
Yeah.
The hard parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have been doing a lot of reflecting on some of the past couple of years and situations and moments. Really, they came down to moments where I could have made another decision and things could have gone differently.
Yeah.
And I'm not dwelling on it. I mean, I'm happy about where I am right now because I'm in a good place and I got here and what it took to get here, I'm going to say was worth all of it.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Cause I think what I see, and this is just my point of view, but in kind of both of you, like I see relationships for you as something that you were doing to give yourself some sort of stimulation. So instead of being able to stick it out long term, let's say in romantic relationships, it's, what can I do or who can I see impulsively? And then it's on to the next. When someone's lost my interest, next person. And it's very much that sort of the hyperactivity part of ADHD, which is like I'm on to the next thing or I'm looking for that quick dopamine hit. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, a little bit of that is also the variety does stem from let's call it your favorite childhood traumas. I was the overactive, excited social butterfly. I mean, I succeeded in a career that involved me being social.
Yeah.
And that was in restaurants and hospitality. I was great at it because I was really great at those quick turnovers. But I've always carried this sort of self-loathing in that I had never had control over myself in a moment. And I guess that stems back to, well, I know it stems back to as a child and growing up, it was just shut up. You're annoying.
Yeah.
Hearing the words sometimes as a child to tell a child, nobody wants you around. I was obsessed with adults. Yeah. Children didn't interest me. They provided me zero stimulation. I wasn't interested in video games and the toys and my imagination worked a little differently. So I wanted to be around adults, but adults, I mentioned that my mom's maid of honor, one of her oldest friend, that she was one of those safe people. And I have a list of, I call them the safe adults, the ones who never made me feel that way, that took interest in children and had patience. Yeah, as a kid, I wanted to be around them. They were interesting because I wanted to learn. But a lot of them didn't want a kid there. And, you know, my parents being parents and, you know, that whole like control your kid thing, it was like, nobody wants a kid around. So I kind of just felt like nobody wants me around for very long.
Yeah.
They want me, but they tire of me quickly. Yeah. And I think that's why I really succeeded in restaurants, because you spend short.
You get to keep it very surface level, very like, oh, we're talking for 2 to 3 minutes, on to the next.
Exactly. Like, and they don't get an idea of who moving. I actually am, and there's not too much exposure. Yeah. You know, it's like limited radiation exposure. I felt like I was the radiation.
You get to keep those protectors up, those walls up. Yeah.
And that spills over into my...
an avoidant attachment.
That spilled over into my personal relationships.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, before, not that anyone's ever really said it to me in recent years that I can remember, but I made sure that that didn't happen by avoiding them. And, you know, being that person who's like, where the hell did he go? What happened? Why? Like, and it made me, I realized, come off as kind of erratic. And then people kind of started growing concern over it. And I, you know, responded defensively. So that was a tough one to navigate. I don't know.
Where were we?
I feel like we were just talking about how I see it.
Oh, yes.
Potentially in past relationships. Like, what I notice more with Matt is, and again, this is just my point of view, but more, I think, pre-shaming yourself for making mistakes, which makes me feel like you've been in relationships, and that could be romantic or friendships, where you felt like you were making mistakes or doing something wrong or not good enough in some way. And then you sort of like, it's like even before something has happened, you already like retreat and feel shame about making a mistake, even if you're not sure if it's actually a mistake yet. And I feel this like, I don't know, hesitation.
The imposter syndrome sort of thing. I feel like for me that's how it was.
Yeah.
I think I'm self-aware in a sense that I don't know where it would have come from. Again, like Julian said, it could have been a childhood trauma. Who's to say? Mm. But
well, I mean, I think even just like looking at, I mean, there's a study that shows that ADHD or neurodivergent children on average, by the time they're 12, have received 20,000 more negative messages about themselves than their neurotypical peers. And so that's these like small, whether they're microaggressions or comments on, you can't do this, you're not doing this right, you're stupid, you're lazy, you're all of these things, you're bad, you're defective in some way, we don't like you, you're annoying. And so that accumulation of just like negative messages about who you are, it stays with you. And then that makes you more susceptible to rejection sensitivity dysphoria, like feeling that intense emotional experience, if it's actual rejection or perceived rejection, and also just, you know, the relational trauma that can come along with having ADHD.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think, you know, a lot of it stemmed from just mostly school, probably, and, you know, teachers just blatantly not liking you for disrupting the class or God knows what, acting out in various ways, getting into fights, just not really knowing how to control and manage emotions. And then I guess having that ideology of yourself over time build up to just negative. And then when you get into that point in your life that you have to start getting into romantic relationships or building like lifelong friendships with people, you start to struggle because you like catch yourself doing stuff and you're like, oh, that I shouldn't do that because of enter scenario from the past. And then, yeah, you retreat. You're like, oh, maybe I just made myself look stupid, and then overthink that this person thought all of these things about you that they probably didn't, you know, shower thoughts. When you're in the shower, you're like, oh, you know what I should have said? Man, I can't believe I said that. They're probably thinking I'm such an idiot right now. And then you just keep doing this self-deprecation all the time. and then just compound as you go. So it's it's not easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're gonna upset the people because of the thought that they thought of you, that you thought they thought of you when they didn't actually think it.
I've won a lot of shower fights. Yeah. Actually I'm probably 100-0 yeah. on shower fights. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't lost one yet. Yeah.
I have a bit of a deeper question to ask both of you. If you could say something to that ADHD boy that didn't understand what ADHD was or was really struggling. So this could be 5-year-old you, 10-year-old you, 15-year-old, whatever kind of age comes up for you. What would you say to him? Knowing what you know now.
You're going to be jacked and wealthy, so fuck them all.
He uses humor.
His shoulders are huge.
He has great shoulders. He does have really good shoulders. He's got fantastic abs as well. That's why I married him. Just kidding. There was other reasons.
Oh, fuck.
And he just gets redder and redder.
My complexion's gonna match my hair color soon. Yeah.
Just think about like if you could talk to the child version of yourself and give him. I mean, it could be a piece of advice. It could be just like a pat on the back. Like, what would you say to him?
Yeah, honestly, I think it would have just been nice to know that it was gonna be okay.
Yeah.
And that people were gonna love you, and that you were gonna figure it out, and that you were gonna be successful regardless of that being monetary or relationship wise. Just like, it's hard when you're a kid, mm-hmm. and this is going to suck for a bit, but just give it time. You will figure out who you are. People will accept you. You'll figure out how to get through this. I think that would have been really nice to know.
Yeah,
that would have been helpful because you feel very, very lost and just not good.
Yeah.
And like it feels like there's no end, you know?
Yeah.
So that would have been nice.
Yeah. Julian, if you could say something to the child version of you, what would you say to him?
I don't know exactly what I would say. Only knowing the child version of me and how distrusting I was of adults.
Mm.
But whatever it was, I would just want him to know nothing was wrong with him.
Mm. That's a good one.
That's it. Because I really just, just thought there was something wrong with me. And when they gave me the pills, but told me I wasn't sick, it was confusing.
Yeah.
So
that's a good one.
I don't know how I would tell him because I don't know that he would believe me.
Yeah.
But that's what I would want him to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one because you're right. There's nothing wrong with you. Although ADHD, even in the name itself, is a deficit, which sort of implies that there's something wrong. Yes, we know that this is a neurodevelopmental disorder. And it's a lifelong disorder, but that doesn't mean that there's something wrong or defective about you. He wants to sit on your lap.
Oh. sit on my lap.
You were born with a different kind of brain.
Yeah.
And that brain, unfortunately, our world isn't set up to promote having a neurodivergent brain because we live in a neurotypical world, but you're okay.
Yeah. Being left-handed.
Oh my god, boy, do I ever hear that ASMR.
Oh yeah, he is going to town on my hand right now. Yeah, thanks, buddy. So what got you into being an ADHD specific therapist?
Wow.
Yeah.
I know. I'm going to turn the tables here. Now I'm podcasting.
Okay. I decided to go into specializing in ADHD because I struggled with my mental health all throughout my 20s before getting properly diagnosed, because an experience getting diagnosed as a woman can be very different from a guy getting diagnosed. And I was always...
Why?
Because ADHD is stigmatized differently, and because typically women fall into more of the inattentive category of ADHD. So that looks very different from that stereotypical boy that can't sit still, is talking in class, is disruptive, and it looks more like the girl that is daydreaming, the girl that has anxiety, the girl that is, you know, zoning out or tuning out. And it's less understood or less obvious in girls. And so I struggled in different ways than the two of you struggled. Like, I went years being told I was depressed, and I was never depressed. I actually, like, at baseline sit at, you know, sort of like above neutral. I'm like pretty happy, pretty energetic. Or I was told I had anxiety, or I was told that I was, you know, maybe I was bipolar, or I had borderline personality disorder, like all kinds of things that were A, untrue, and B, pretty stigmatized, instead of someone being able to realize, like, no, I think this girl just has ADHD, and that's why she can't cope, she can't manage her life. And so when I was in my master's to become a therapist, I wanted to be able to give other people who had ADHD someone that actually really understood them, and not just see it as this thing like, oh, okay, well, you've got ADHD, but let's treat all of these other things. Instead, let's look at ADHD as the core issue before we start tackling anxiety or depression or relationship dysfunction or all of these other things. Let's treat the ADHD first. And so that's, you know, where the kind of passion came in for me. On if I had had me when I was in my 20s, I think my life probably would have looked very different.
Knowing what you know, and like your knowledge, your experience, what would you tell yourself?
I think that I would probably be less likely to give her advice and maybe want to have a conversation where she could give me some advice, because that girl was a badass, and she was, I mean, working too hard and still getting a lot of things done and still, you know, advocating for herself, and really surviving. So kudos to her. I could take some of that energy back for sure. But I think if I was going to give myself any piece of advice, it would be, keep searching for the answer. Don't give up on yourself. Like, even though there's all of these people telling you that there's nothing wrong with you, or that this thing is wrong with you, even though you don't believe that, just keep pushing and pursuing and trying to find an answer, because there is an answer. You just haven't found it yet, but to just keep trying.
Thanks for tuning in to ADHD Brief. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing or sharing it with someone who might relate. For more information on resources from today's episode, check out the show notes on your listening platform, or feel free to contact us directly. The views and opinions shared by my guests are their own and may not always reflect mine. At ADHD Brief, we value open conversations and differing perspectives. I encourage listeners to approach each episode with kindness and curiosity. Even when something comes from a place of stigma or misunderstanding, offering grace and compassion creates more room for growth than criticism ever could. Thanks for tuning in.